Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's a pleasure to talk about the art of dating. And I'm going to explain what I mean by that. But before I do, I was just having a lovely conversation with Sarah, who is a mechanical engineer. And she told me that she's taking a course, an entire course on heat transfer. So I think my next talk is going to be called The Art of Dating, : Virtuous Heat Transfer. What do you think? All right, well, it's a working title. But the reason why I did call dating an art is because it is an art. It's like any other skill. It's something you learn, it's something you practice, and if you practice it well, it is a beautiful thing that gives glory to God. So there is nothing wrong with cultivating this art. You don't do it for its own sake, as we'll get into in just a few moments, but it is a good skill to have. With respect to the practice of this art, there are a few things that you and I have in common, and then there are a few things we don't have in common. So I have been married for 26 years. I have 6 kids. That means that when my wife and I were dating, it was and was not a different world. So let me start with the things that I think we all still have in common. One is the basic fact, what has not changed over time is that men and women have this habit of being attracted to each other. As my mother-in-law once observed, every generation likes to think that it has invented sex. But of course it hasn't, right? You think, oh, we are the ones that are really in touch with our feelings or whatever, right? There's a temptation to think of your generation as unique. But of course, these are age-old human problems or challenges. The second thing that you and I have in common is, despite the generation that separates us, we both lived or are living in the wake of the sexual revolution. The sexual revolution of the 1960s for American society was a huge game changer. For one thing, prior to the 60s, there were almost universal rules for dating. Men and women knew what it meant to go out on a date. You could bend the rules, you could break the rules, but at least everyone knew what the rules were. In the 1960s, in the name of freedom, we threw out these rules. We threw out the playbook in order to become more sexually free. The irony of that decision, however, is that in my experience and the experience of people I've talked to, my own experience, my children, my students, rather than become more free, we actually become more paralyzed. Because once you destroy all the walls, all the boundaries, you just don't know what your first move is, right? So rather than being liberating, it ends up being paralyzing. It ends up being constricting, right? Just to give a small side example, we take things like social rituals for granted. So when I met my host tonight, we told each other our name, we looked each other in the eye, we shook hands, we didn't have to think about what to do. And that shared social ritual then enables us to get to know each other better. What if there were no shared social rituals? And then we're meeting each other for the first time, like, do I give you my foot? Do I dance around you? You know, like, what if we didn't have a shared way of greeting one another? That wouldn't be liberating. It would be confusing, right? So having shared social rituals regarding dating made sense, but they were thrown out. And my generation had to deal with that, and your generation has to deal with that. So we do have that in common. What we don't have in common is that when my wife and I were dating, it was before the internet was really taking off and before social media was taking off, right? So breaking up by text was not an option for us, which I don't recommend, by the way. Obviously, that changes the social media, changes the dynamic in a lot of ways. And there are good things to it. There are bad things to it. One thing I have noticed about social media is that it increases the temptation for phoniness. What I mean by that is this. Every generation is concerned about how it looks in front of other people, right? Every person is concerned with their reputation in front of others. But there was a time when that was only a 9-to-5 job. When at the end of the day of being, you know, you spent all day being a phony, but then at the end of the day, you go home to your place, you draw the curtains, and you can just relax. But it seems now that there's just this constant need to present the right face in front of others, right? There's a constant need to text, "I'm doing great. Look what I'm eating," you know? It's a constant performance. Again, I see that as something that can just be exhausting. And not only that, you spend all your time presenting this face, you forget what your real face is, right? So that can definitely be a complicating factor. And then the second complicating factor, and I really don't want to be a downer, but I do have to mention it, is the sharp rise of pornography. I hate to sound like an old man, but in my day, it was relatively hard. I mean, you could still do it. There were Playboy magazines around, but now, holy cow. And it's not just young men, it's young women. And it's so easy to graduate to the most vile forms of porn, thanks to its easy accessibility. And this has a terrible impact on relationships. Non-chemical forms of addiction are still forms of addiction, right? Gambling and pornography actually has the same effect on the brain as an addiction to alcohol or drugs, right? And then it's never just a personal thing. It affects your relationship with other human beings. So alas, that is something to be worried about and needless to say, something to avoid at all costs. All right, so that's the sort of background. So let's get into the question of how should men and women relate to each other? And I will give you three options. They can relate to each other as friends. They can relate to each other on dates. And they can relate to each other in courtship. I know that's an old-fashioned term, but I can't think of another one. Relate to each other as friends. Can men and women be friends? Absolutely. But when you are friends with a member of the opposite sex, you do have to be cognizant of the fact that it will always be more complicated than having a friend of the same sex. There will always be an element of tension. And that's okay. But you just simply have to be aware that of having a friend, a platonic friend of the opposite sex, will always carry with it a certain tension. And, you know, I don't think tensions are bad, but you do have to acknowledge them and in a sense, be more aware of them than when you're just hanging out with a buddy of the same sex, right? The second option is to go out on a date with someone. Now, here's where it gets complicated. The very term dating has changed over the years. In the 1950s, to go out on a date meant to enter into a romantically possible outing, but it was not exclusive. It was not monogamous. You could be a virtuous young woman, go out on a date with Bob on a Monday, and then go out on a date with Bill on a Wednesday, and it was totally acceptable. Dating was just different men and women going out, getting to know each other in a somewhat, you know, one-on-one situation, but there were no strings attached. And it was virtuous, right? This isn't like a hookup culture. You would just get to know each other. And then if the two of you really did like each other, well, maybe you'd go out on another date. And maybe you'd go out on another date. And then to use the 1950s lingo, when you did go monogamous, when you were only exclusively dating one another, you were going steady, right? Now, I'm not asking us to bring back these words or what have you, but I do think it's a helpful way to think about it, right? And going steady meant that you were courting. That meant that you were dating with an eye towards discernment of marriage, right? So that's the sort of general background. It would be nice if we could kind of go back to that model. I don't want to sound nostalgic, but I do see a lot of advantages to it. Unfortunately, I think there has to be a cultural shift for that to work. In other words, I think both men and women in the same community need to be equally on board, or there can be misunderstandings, right? Like, Bill asks a girl out on a Monday and she's flattered, and then he asks another girl out on a Wednesday and girl number one is horrified, you know, and thinks he's a cad. No, I'm just observing 1950s models of dating. Oh, now I feel so much better, right? So honestly, I don't know the answer. Here's what I do know. What do all these three forms of interaction have in common? Basically, I think our goal is the same in all three cases, and it is truly to be a better lover in the best sense of that term, right? And so what does it mean as a Christian to be a better lover? Well, the first thing it means is to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your might and all your soul. And then only secondly, to love your neighbor as yourself. So this may not sound like very good practical advice, but it still needs to be the bedrock. We really need to love God first. And it sounds terribly unromantic, but it is nevertheless true that you need to love God more than your spouse. And I know that, again, sounds unromantic, but there's a paradox. The more you love God, the better a lover you will be to your spouse. Again, in the pure sense of that word, a lover. Because what's the alternative? If you love your spouse more than God, you are making your spouse God. You are making them fill the shoes of God in your life. And no matter how awesome your spouse is, no human being can live up to the expectations, right? We live, of course, in a society that has, what, 50% divorce rate. I'm sure in many, many cases, it's because the couple didn't take marriage seriously enough. But I do wonder if there aren't also a lot of cases where there's a way in which they took marriage too seriously. That is to say, they got married thinking, if I can just marry him or her, then I'll be happy. Such a big temptation. But if you think that way, you're basically saying, they're my God that's going to save me. They're my God that's going to make me happy. Well, you've just put a huge amount of pressure on the relationship, right? So number one, love God first. Don't use anyone or anything as a substitute for God. And number two, love your neighbor as yourself. Isn't it interesting the way that our Lord put that? Love your neighbor as yourself. So in other words, it has to start, the love of neighbor has to start with a proper self-love. It is very, very understandable when meeting someone, when dating someone, when courting someone, to ask the question, is he the one? Is she the one? But there's a wonderful book on dating that came out about 15 years ago, and I can't remember the name of the author. But the title she gave to the book is, Am I the One? rather than keep asking, is he the one? Is she the one? Our first question is, am I the kind of person who has the character, the integrity to attract the kind of person I want? Right? Am I the one? What am I doing to love myself properly, to cultivate a life of virtue and integrity that could authentically attract the kind of person I want? Right? I do think that's the way we should be thinking about that. And then that improves our relationships to others. If I am a genuinely good person, I'm going to will the good for the other. I won't be dating in order to use someone, exploit someone, right? Get a free meal. Hey, a girl's got to eat. But but to have a more genuine interest, less mercenary interest in the other, right? So that's the general stuff that I got for the night. And then the last thing I have is three bits of advice, specifically for men, three bits of advice explicitly for women. By the way, I used to give this talk with my wife, Alexandra, who incidentally is a huge Buckeye fan. She actually, her father taught at Ohio State many decades ago. So she wanted to come, but unfortunately was unable to. So we did a couple things with our local parish. Eventually we just taught it together. And then I would give one spiel and she'd give the other spiel. But I do have a funny story to share with you. When we first started, I would give the talk only to the guys and she would give the talk only to the girls. So we advertised it like this. A woman called me and said, I would like to know if my daughter can attend your talk that you're giving to the guys. And I said, well, I really would prefer not to, so we can talk about things in a more open, frank way. But I'm curious, why did you want your daughter to attend the talk that the only guys would show up at? And she said, well, I figured that the guys who would show up to a talk on how to date like a gentleman would be super eligible for my daughter. And I said, smart mom, smart mom. So let me give you my three bits of advice to men. So I guess my first bit of advice is, don't be afraid to ask a woman out on a date. And don't unnecessarily hide behind friendship. I mean, it's okay to start out as friends, but if you genuinely are interested in this young lady, there's a way in which, if you eventually don't disclose your feelings in a proper way, well, I'm just gonna be honest, you're just being chicken shit. Right? Like, cultivate friendships, but don't hide behind them, right? If you're interested, show your interest. Because then that can be, then you're abusing friendship, you know? And then that can complicate things. So, I mean, that doesn't mean jump the gun, but, you know, find the right moment and man up. The second thing I would say to young men is don't be afraid to date up. Don't ever think she's out of my league. I'm never going to be able to go out with her. I'm happy to report myself as a success story. Alexandra was way out of my league and I didn't care. I wanted to ask Alexandra out on a date and I did. And six kids later, you know, no complaints. And then the third bit of advice I would give to young men is think of yourself as a knight in shining armor, right? So one very common question is often asked by both men and women is, how far can we go, right? It's a totally understandable question. Incidentally, I'm not going to go into specifics, but the traditional answer is not very. I will share with you another funny story. I had a theology professor who, it was actually a theology of marriage class we were taking, and he shared a story. One of his students once came up to him and said, "Dr. Perella, is it a mortal sin to French kiss?" And he said, "Sally, when it comes to these matters, I tend to take things tongue-in-cheek." That's funny, come on. You just wanted the answer, didn't you? Well, I'm not giving it to you. So it is an understandable thing to ask, how far can we go? But it really is the wrong question to ask. A knight in shining armor asks, how do I continue to protect the dignity of this young woman? How do I protect my dignity? How do I protect her dignity? Because a knight is at the service of a damsel. He's not there to exploit her or abuse her. He is there to protect and serve, right? So, gentlemen, put on your armor. Think of yourself as a knight. You are called to a noble life as a baptized Catholic Christian. And that's the attitude you should bring with you when dating, right? So those are my three bits of advice to the men. All right, so now the three bits of advice to women come from my wife, Alexandra. So at this point, I would like you to exercise your imagination and not imagine some creepy middle-aged man standing before you saying things to you, but my lovely wife, Alexandra. Point number one. Sex is good. I know, you see why I'm embarrassed? Sex is the way God chose to create immortal human life. The devil wants you to either use it the wrong way or think that it is bad. Do neither, right? It is a tremendous gift, a tremendous privilege, but one that is meant to be used the right way. Don't let the devil get in your head and push you to either extreme. The second bit of advice that my wife would offer you is let him ask you out and let him pay the dinner, right? That sounds rude. Let him pay. Not like that. And the reason is not moral, it's psychological. If, ladies, you do ever ask a man out on a date, you do not need to go to the confessional and say, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. I asked out Bill." Right? You don't need to do that. There's nothing immoral in a woman asking a man out for a date. The reasons are entirely psychological. And I can say this as a man. Men have a very funny psyche. And it is actually to the benefit of a man's psychological development that you allow him the space to man up and ask you out. You may have heard the story of when baby chicks hatch. When you see a chick struggling to break out of a shell, it's very tempting to open the shell for them, but it's actually very damaging to the chick because it's the act of breaking out of the shell that develops the muscles that enable them to live outside the shell. And so when farmers open up the egg for the chick, those chicks usually perish later because they never developed the muscles. Guys, I'm sorry, but we are baby chicks who need to peck our way out of the shell ourselves. So ladies, do not be moved by a false sense of compassion and open their shell for them, right? And then the last thing, and this I think applies to both men and women, dating is discernment, right? You are discerning, you could be discerning a vocation in marriage versus a vocation to the clerical life, the religious life. But it's also a discernment of, is this person the one? Dating is discernment. Therefore, a breakup is not a failure, right? Because the point of the art of dating is not to simply hook this person come hell or high water, right? The point is discernment. And so if you discern out or he or she discerns out, that's okay. Better a breakup than a terrible marriage. You know, what is Shakespeare's great line? Better well hanged than ill wed. But it's really true. Man, bad marriages be bad, right? So if you discern out or she discerns out or whatever, it's not a failure. That's a success, right? Just as in science, when you conduct an experiment and the experiment goes wrong, well, that's one thing you know doesn't work. And now that narrows the field for what does, right? Failures in science are not failures. They're learning experiences. And the same is true in the art of dating. So in conclusion, I have good news for you. There is a way to combine romance and honor. Because isn't that essentially what we're talking about? Romance is being attracted to another person. But then the question becomes, especially in this post-sexual revolution age, how do I do that with honor? And it is a hard question when the rule book has been thrown out, but it's still possible. It is possible to declare or to combine romance and honor and fidelity to our faith. Romance is good and it can be done well. And that is the hopeful note on which I wish to leave you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.